In 1776, as the United States declared its independence, the vast landscapes of North America were already home to rich ecosystems and to indigenous peoples who had stewarded them for generations. Over the next 250 years, the story of this land became intertwined with industry, expansion, and eventually a growing awareness that when we take from nature, we must also protect it. This is the Future of Conservation podcast, and this year, we're bringing you a special series from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, created for America's 250th anniversary. In each episode, we explore the past, present, and future of American conservation through the voices of people who've lived it, shaped it, and are reimagining what comes next. From mountain peaks to coastal marshes, from rivers running with freshwater fish and mussels, to skies filled with eagles and migratory songbirds. From dense forests to coral reefs and city greenways, we explore the ever-changing connection between people and the wild, by air, by land, by water. I'm Megan Bean, and you're listening to The Future of Conservation. Today, we dive into the story of fisheries conservation, where it began, how it's changing, and the groundbreaking innovation shaping a future where both fish and people can thrive. First, the past. The growing population of America needed to be fed, and the U.S. Fish Commission, an agency that would later become the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, was tasked with helping to meet that demand. The challenge? How do you produce more fish when wild populations are being depleted? In the mid-1800s, the United States was experiencing a rapid expansion of human activity, driven by the desire to use its vast natural resources. Often, these resources were exploited with little to no regulation. Clear-cutting forests, building dams, expanding cities, and growing industrial development disrupted waterways and polluted the habitats that fish and other aquatic species depended on. One of the key innovators of this era was Livingston Stone, who confronted overfishing head-on in response to the growing need to feed a booming population. A true pioneer, Stone served as a federal employee who opened California's first freshwater fish station and later became the U.S. Deputy Commissioner for the Pacific Coast with the U.S. Fish Commission. At a time when trains were the only way to cross the country, Stone accomplished something remarkable: successfully transporting live fish across thousands of miles. Species like shad, striped bass, catfish, and even lobsters were moved from the Northeast to the West Coast. This was no small feat. It required 2,000-gallon aquariums, milk cans packed with ice, and hand-operated aeration systems to keep the water oxygenated. Solving the challenge of long-distance transportation of live fish and eggs became a turning point for fisheries management and laid the groundwork for fish restocking programs not just in the United States, but around the world. And now, the present. National fish hatcheries were some of the earliest federal conservation efforts in America. Thanks to the contributions of generations of fish biologists and other fisheries workers, aquatic conservation has made leaps and bounds since the National Fish Hatchery System began restoring aquatic species in 1872. Today, 71 hatcheries across the United States raise millions of fish and aquatic wildlife for recreational fisheries with partners. Our hatchery system boosts local economies, fulfills tribal trust responsibilities, helps recover threatened and endangered species, and prevents at-risk species from becoming endangered. One of the many hatcheries carrying out this critical work is Mora National Fish Hatchery in New Mexico, which has been breeding and raising Gila trout since 1999. I spoke with Daniel Gallegos, project leader and fish biologist, whose team will have a lasting impact on the conservation of this threatened species. So tell me a little bit about the Gila trout and what makes it so special.
So the Gila trout is one of two native trout species in the state of New Mexico. And they're also native to Arizona, right? So in my mind, they're a native treasure. And their coloration, right? They have a golden belly. The best way I've heard it explained is that Gila trout stole their coloration from the New Mexico sunset. They're such a beautiful fish, and I think they mean so much. They're just a Southwest treasure. So being able to work with them, currently listed as threatened, and being able to contribute to Gila trout recovery is just a big thing for the facility and for the team.
Yeah, speaking of Southwest treasures, what makes Mora National Fish Hatchery itself so special?
Mora National Fish Hatchery is so unique. It's one of the few hatcheries that I would say in the world, right? In the country, we depend fully on recirculating aquaculture systems, meaning we reuse our water. So we're reusing up to 95% of our water, which is super great, right? There's other facilities you think of, and they use a lot of water to accomplish their mission, which is great because the water's there, right? Here in the Southwest, we don't have that luxury to have a bunch of water. So being able to reuse our water is key for us here. And the facility, right? This is technically it's the second newest federal hatchery in the country, which isn't too new anymore, right? It was passed through Congress in 92. They started building in 94, and it was operational in 98. But this hatchery is so unique because we're the only hatchery in the world raising Gila trout for recovery purposes. And there's nobody else that does it. So every time we get new staff on board, I always like to joke around with them, and I tell them that we're the only ones in the world raising them. And I'm like, hey, no pressure, no pressure.
Yeah, sounds like a really special job, a special calling for folks. It must also be the team that makes the work so important too.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely.
What do you think are the greatest challenges facing our hatchery system today?
I think the National Fish Hatchery system as a whole, you know, a lot of hatcheries are experiencing just lower flow rates, right? There's less and less water. There's lots of drought, and hatcheries that are depend on spring water or they're bringing their water source in, diverting it into the hatchery. Their flows are just decreasing every year, which is a big challenge, right? If you don't have a good water supply, then you can't raise good quality fish. So, but that's why I think one big great thing for us here is that we're reusing water. So I think this is some cutting-edge technology and infrastructure that, in my opinion, I think is going to be a big key factor in the future of fisheries and for the National Fish Hatchery System is needing to depend and to reuse water on a more frequent basis.
I know that you all have had to been creative in coming up with some solutions to the challenges you face. Have you come up with any other interesting solutions to problems that have made a really big difference in the fish conservation work that you do?
Oh yeah. Recently, we've had some phenomenal success here on station. The historical average IUP rate for Gila trout was 20%, and the average survival for younger year fish was 30%. So in 2022, the IUP rate was 16%, and survival for younger year was 10%. So myself and the biologist, we came back and I was like, hey, let's work together and develop some new protocol and start looking into this to see how we can improve this. And we completely rewrote all of our protocol basically across the board. And we've had phenomenal success. We've increased our IUP. Now our average IUP is around 85%. Our survival for younger year Gila trout is about 90%. So we've completely turned the program around. We've been making some huge changes to make the overall facilities and the workload that we have to complete as efficient as possible. So we've been installing new tanks and changing the whole protocol and the way that things were done in the past. We're just completely changing it and making it as efficient as possible. And it's proved very worthy because now it's lightened up our workload a lot. It's freeing up a lot of time to focus on other things. And since our success rates are so high, it's right now we don't need as many fish and as many eggs to meet our requests and to meet the demand that we have for Gila trout. And in my mind, that is obviously great, but a huge, huge part of it is being able to share this information with others. So we are sharing this information across the country, and there's other state and federal hatcheries implementing some of this protocol that we're sharing with them, and they're seeing increase in their IUPs and survival rates too. So it's great for us to be able to develop and fine-tune this protocol and then to be able to share it with others to help others all across the country.
For anybody who's listening to this who's not sure what it means, can you tell us what IUP means?
Yeah. So IUP rate. So whenever you spawn a fish and you get all the green eggs, right? So you get eggs out of the female and you fertilize them. When you send them down to incubate, there's only a certain percentage of them that will reach the IUP stage where you could actually visually see the eyeball and the embryo inside the egg. So for us with Gila trout and our water temperature, it takes around 21 days for them to reach that eye up stage, right? So we'll put the eggs down and then we'll have to wait 21 days. And then we pick out any of the dead eggs and then we do the math to figure out what the percentages of the eyed eggs. Then that's our eye up, right? So again, thinking out of the total eggs that we collect and having 85% of those eggs eye up, which means that they're a good viable egg and they're gonna hatch, is super, super great, right?
Yeah, that's incredible. I'm sure all the folks you are working with and sharing this information with are thrilled too. Can you tell me a little bit about your process of working with partners and other fish biologists in the state hatcheries? How do you all come together and communicate?
So one big way that we come together for more specifically for Gila trout is a few years ago, I started having some discussions with our state hatcheries that they raise Gila trout for recreational purposes. There's a state hatchery in New Mexico and a state hatchery in Arizona, and then we're the federal hatchery here that raises Gila trout for recovery purposes. But I started having discussions with them, and I'm like, well, hey, man, like all three of us are the only three hatcheries in the world raising Gila trout. Yeah, we have different missions, right? Your guys' missions are for recreational, ours is for recovery. But at the end of the day, it's the same species. I said, I think it'd be worthwhile if we created a Gila trout work group and we have an annual meeting and we share all of our data, raw data, right? Share our success, failures, struggles, anything, and any time of the year, if we're having any problems or issues, we can reach out to each other. So we created that Gila trout work group. And as a matter of fact, just this past week, we just had our third annual Gila trout work group meeting. We hosted it here on station. So we had staff from the two other state hatcheries travel here to the facility. Each station gave a station update, and we're brainstorming ideas overall to just help each other out and ensure that all three facilities are successful. So that's one big way that we collaborate with our state partners, specifically with Gila trout. But yeah, we collaborate with state partners, other federal partners, tribal partners. We work real closely with the Mescalero Tribal Fish Hatchery. We work super close with them and help them out building systems and troubleshooting any issues they have. And then sharing our protocol, right? Anything that we've learned, we've shared. And I know Lahontan National Fish Hatchery has implemented some things and they've had an increase in their eye up rate. I think it was by 15%. So it's great to see. It's great to see everybody succeeding. That's the goal, is to share this information so everybody's successful.
Yeah, it sounds like this is a great case study in how important that part of our mission and working with others is. Seems like you guys have really built a great coalition to support each other. So exciting to hear about conservation successes like this for recreation and conservation. Thanks, Daniel. Is there any other ideas in fisheries technology or new practices that you're really excited about?
Something that I and you mentioned it, right? Working with others. I think that's a big part is that we need to do moving forward in the future, right? Is sharing that information, right? There's a bunch of federal hatcheries across the country. There's national fish hatcheries, state hatcheries, they're raising the same species, but we should all meet and discuss and share that information to see what the success rates are and if other people can share information. That's something that I think we're moving into next is really trying to work with others and share this information, anything that we can to help other facilities out. But that's something that we're really excited about now in the present is sharing the information from the success that we've been having.
Yeah, I find that so exciting too. I mean, when you think about it, the science that you're doing at your federal facility, that belongs to everybody because it's funded by the government, and being able to share more of it for partners, for states, for tribes, I find that idea really fascinating. I'm so glad that I got to talk to you about this. Do you have any goals for Mora for 2026? If you're making your New Year's resolutions for your hatchery, what are you thinking about?
Our goal is to continue to keeping our trends where they've been, right? With the eye up and survival rates, keeping them pretty steady and helping out others. One big thing that we would really like to do is potentially start looking into bringing a new species on station. Right? We've made the program super efficient here with Gila trout, where we've freed up a lot of time, resources, tank space, right? So we have time, resources, and space available. So I think that would be something great if it's possible and right, we get regional approval and to bring in another species to contribute, whether it's working with another T&E species, right, for recovery purposes or even working with a species for recreational purposes. But I think that's something that we would be excited about for 2026 is if we could do that.
Yeah, we'll have to follow up with you again and see if anything comes to fruition from that exciting idea. I know we'll be hearing more success from your hatchery at Mora for sure. Thanks so much. And I think a parting question. So you've been in this business for quite a long time. You've been with the Fish and Wildlife Service for how many years now?
Let me take a pause and think about that one. I've been with Fish and Wildlife Service for going on 14 years.
14
14
years.
years, yeah. And I started was I actually started as a Youth Conservation Corps program, YCC summer program. But yeah, 14 years later and still living the dream every day and loving the job.
Yeah. What would you tell somebody just starting out in their career in hatcheries or fisheries? Today's their first day. What would you tell them?
My advice to them would be to work hard, do a great job at what you're doing, and don't be afraid to take risk. Don't be afraid to take a risk and ask lots of questions. And the other thing is work towards your goals, but whenever you reach and achieve your goals and get where you want to be, in my mind, that's not true success. That is being successful. But in my opinion, true success is when you work hard, you reach your goals, and you get where you want to be, but then you reach back and help others get there.
And now, the future. Today's fisheries professionals are balancing more demands than ever before. Limited space, growing conservation needs, and the responsibility to protect genetic diversity all collide inside our hatcheries. So how do you move forward when traditional approaches begin to reach their limits? One answer may lie in the freezer. And it's reshaping what conservation could look like in the decades ahead. That idea brings us to the future of America's fisheries. Valerie Kearney is a fish biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the Warm Springs Fish Technology Center. She leads innovative cryopreservation research, preserving cells and living materials at freezing temperatures to maintain viability after thaw, and banking genetic resources for fish species nationwide. Her work focuses on fish milt or sperm from more than 40 species, including pallid sturgeon, cutthroat trout, and Atlantic salmon. By developing new methods to safeguard genetic material, Valerie is helping reduce the number of broodstock that must be maintained at hatcheries across the country. This research is pushing conservation beyond the limits of physical space and into a future that is far more flexible, scalable, and resilient. Catherine Blalock spoke with Kearney to learn more.
Valerie, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So to kind of kick us off, what was your very first, like, wow, fish are amazing moment?
Wow, let's see. In life in general, my very first fish are amazing. Well, in the seventh grade, I did a science fair project where I tried to train goldfish to go through a maze. And I remember being astounded that they were actually able to improve over time. And it was just one of those things where I was excited and astounded that, you know, a little project I did worked and that the fish were far smarter than a lot of people gave them credit for.
That is super fun. What a fun little science experiment. Goldfish, who knew? That's really cool. That's a great example. So for people who have never heard the term before, you said you were a lab manager for the cryopreservation unit at Warm Springs. And can you explain what cryopreservation is and why it's so valuable for conservation?
Of course. So yes, I work at the Warm Springs Fish Technology Center within the cryopreservation laboratory. And cryopreservation is essentially being able to store cells or living material at super cold temperatures with the ability of them maintaining life and viability post-thaw. So liquid nitrogen is involved and some other chemicals are involved. But yeah, it's a really cool tool to be able to bank genetic resources and to mitigate all sorts of different production issues in the hatchery setting. So yeah.
What kind of species are you working with the cryopreservation specifically?
We focus on fish milt, so sperm, because that is much easier to freeze than eggs. Fish eggs are giant, makes it much more difficult. So we work across the country. We're the only cryopreservation lab with the service, and we work on so many different species. I believe over the life of the lab, which began in the 90s, probably 40 plus species we've worked with. Right now, we've been working with a lot of salmonids, different cutthroats, trout species. We've worked with Gila trout, Apache trout, Chinook salmon, kokanee salmon, chum salmon, Atlantic salmon. We've, one of our big programs is pallid sturgeon. We work with all sorts of different species, and one of the things we do, because every species has unique cellular properties, we do have to do a little research to be able to figure out the best protocols to preserve that different species material.
Wow, that's really cool. And it's great that, you know, you're just one technology center, but you're able to support fish hatcheries all across the country. Can you talk about your partnership with Craig Brook National Fish Hatchery?
A couple of years ago now, Craig Brook reached out because they were experiencing, what would I call it? Their effluent was too high in phosphorus, I believe. And so they were encountering some state EPA type issues, trying to mitigate that. They were already doing intensive water treatment. And one of the ways to reduce some of the nutrient loads in your effluent would be to reduce the number of fish you hold. So they wanted to explore the idea of holding less males, but still meeting their production demands. And one way to do that would be to use cryopreservation to just hold the sperm of males and still have that high genetic diversity available. We went up there and did some research trials to figure out an appropriate method to be able to maintain post-thaw viability. And that project is still in the works as far as implementing a full-blown program with cryopreservation, but we were able to get some really phenomenal numbers as far as when we did a fertilization trial to test frozen thawed sperm on eggs, and had, I believe, frozen thawed sperm with one of the methods work 94% as well as fresh sperm, which is pretty good in the cryopreservation world. That was cool, and it was really awesome to see their program up there.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you were talking about how cryopreservation really helps hatcheries save on space. So were they able to remove the tank that was causing the extra effluent with the amount of space saved through the freezing of the genetics?
They have, so we're still kind of in the research stage with them.
Okay.
They have reduced through upping their par collections and holding fish not as long. They have reduced some of their numbers through that route. And we're still working on being able to establish a full-blown cryo program with them to reduce numbers even further. So that's, it's an ongoing thing, but it's definitely a cool way to potentially keep that genetic diversity up and reduce how many animals you're holding.
What are some other ways that the Technology Center is supporting the challenges hatcheries face.
We also have a, in addition to the cryopreservation lab, we have a genetics lab at Auburn, and they do a lot of work with fish, and they also do a lot of work with snails and mussels, helping recovery of particularly low numbered populations, maintain genetic diversity, helping answer questions like that. And then at the cryo lab, we do some other stuff as well. I also work on novel species production research, and I work in freshwater mussel in vitro production. So that would be a freshwater mussel has glaucidia, which attach to fish gills for the first part of their life cycle. And sometimes if it's a particularly threatened or endangered species, and the fish host might not be known, or that fish host is also threatened or endangered or in threat, I can basically use cell culture methods to rear them through their parasitic stage. So I do some research in that field as well.
What does it look like day to day in the lab setting, doing this really kind of futuristic research for fisheries, for mussels? You mentioned some other species too. What does that kind of look like in the lab setting?
I'm not necessarily in the lab every single day. A big part of the cryopreservation program is maintaining our database. When you're cryopreserving things, there might be instances where a partner or a hatchery requests a specific male or a specific strain that could have been something frozen 20 years ago. And so having a very detailed log or database that has all of the information to be able to track down that specific individual and all of the information associated with that animal is really important. So I do spend a fair amount of time on the computer working on that sort of stuff. And then in the lab, it depends on the season. All of our different species we work with often have different spawning seasons. So we will have partners shipping us milt or fish sperm, and we'll be freezing it upon arrival. And so freezing it will look like we add an assortment of different salt solutions, and we'll add a cryoprotective agent, which is a chemical that is what's going to protect the cell from osmotic damage during freezing. So a lot of times that might be something like methanol or dimethyl sulfoxide. So we'll calculate how much of that to put in it, and we'll load it into these little straws, and then we will often rest those on a platform that is above liquid nitrogen to slowly bring it down to liquid nitrogen's temperature, which is negative 196 degrees Celsius. And then we will make sure we enter all of the data and store it in a container called a Dewar, which is basically a thermos for liquid nitrogen. And then I'm routinely adding liquid nitrogen to all of these containers to be able to keep them at these sub-zero temperatures and keep them basically suspended in animation, if you will. I have some animals that I do daily animal care and whatnot. And yeah, it's kind of a day-to-day.
That just sounds so interesting. So how long can the frozen cells last? You mentioned 20 years to find, like, go back and find a male strain from 20 years ago. How long does it last?
Basically indefinitely.
Very cool. Some resiliency for sure.
Yeah, we've sent samples frozen 25 years ago to partners, and they've produced viable young. It is kind of
That's
wild
impressive.
to think yeah. that yeah.
So kind of going off that, what's the coolest or most unexpected thing you've learned since starting this program with cryopreservation?
I think basically that.
Yeah.
When I was first really learning and reading a lot, the concept of adding these chemicals that are preventing osmotic damage, and it all has to be timed just right, because the chemicals exposed to the cell for too long before freezing could be toxic. But you need just that perfect amount of time for the, you know, solute ratio inside and outside the cell to be right, so the ice crystals don't destroy the cell. And so that, and then reading papers about just the idea in some of these different species eggs, like rainbow trout, they have a micropyle, which is a small little opening on the egg that the cell, that the sperm cell has to enter. And there's only one on this huge egg. And the sperm are so small and only swim for so long upon being activated that it's just, it's the miracle of life, I guess. It's amazing.
That's fascinating. And just all the data needed to do your job and to do it well. It sounds like so much to manage and such a cool opportunity to be involved in. Final question for you, even though we can keep on talking for a longer amount of time for sure. So it's really fascinating to think that the future of fisheries is being safeguarded in a freezer. When you think about that future, what gives you the most hope?
I think what gives me the most hope is the people I've met who work for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the people I've met in the conservation field in general. These are people who are not doing it for money. They show up despite all of the hardships in life, and they put their everything into saving what they love, which is fish, wildlife, and the habitats they live in. And I just admire so many of the people I've met in this field and how much they dedicate to a mission they believe in, so the American people can keep enjoying these beautiful resources.
Yeah, definitely a worthy mission to be working for. That's a great answer. I love that. Well, thank you so much for your time, Valerie. This has been a lot of fun just to learn about your work and what you're doing to steward our waters and protect the fish for generations to come. So really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
From ice-packed milk cans on trains to modern hatcheries and even freezers storing fish genetic material, America's fisheries have always been innovative. Today, hatcheries and new technologies are helping species and people thrive together. Let's steward our waters and protect fish for generations to come. Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Future of Conservation, part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's celebration of America's 250th anniversary. There's so much more to explore, from online exhibits and community events to educational resources and volunteer opportunities. We welcome you to dive deeper into the history and future of conservation in America. Visit us online with a link in the show notes to learn how you can get involved. And coming in 2026, don't miss America's Wildlife, By the People, For the People, a new film that tells the powerful story of how generations of Americans have shaped and been shaped by our country's wildlife and wild places. Until next time, thank you for being a part of the story and shaping the future of conservation.